Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's take a trip back to the dawning of the Soviet Union. Dave Burrow is an associate professor of history at the University of South Dakota. He's talking about Soviet propaganda this week as part of the University of South Dakota's Sound, Color, Shape. It's an interdisciplinary symposium. It explores the human experience through music, art, drama, neuroscience, history, mathematics, and words. Dave Burrow, welcome. In the moment.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
We're here in the studios at the University of South Dakota. Dave, tell me a little bit about this event and the interaction that occurs between the professors as you sort of decide what you're going to bring to hang on this umbrella of sound, color, shape.
Well, the originator of this conference was Paul Lombardi, who's in the music department as a composer and also happens to be my neighbor here in Vermilion. And so my invitation to participate in this was a pretty casual one because he and his wife were walking down the street and he said, "Hey, I'm putting this conference together. Do you have any ideas about, and here's the general theme, do you have any ideas?" And I said, "Well, you know, Soviet propaganda had particular color palettes that it had to use and there's a lot of interesting stuff that you could do." So I think that the conference came together largely through Paul's soliciting colleagues from modern languages and the English department and basic biomedical sciences and people who have done research or who can think about sort of the intersection between sound and color and neurology and all sorts of other, all sorts of other interesting areas. But I think you have to give Paul credit for putting the program together.
And so it takes place on the campus during the day, during school hours, and sort of spreads out with all these sort of fascinating conversations across the campus. Am I understanding that right?
Yep. It starts tomorrow at 10 o'clock in Colton Recital Hall in the Fine Arts Building on campus. And Laura Vidler from Modern Languages is giving a talk called Mirror Neurons, Kinesthetic Empathy in the Adoption of Early Modern Spanish Drama. Oh. And then I follow up with Color and Messaging in Mid-Century Soviet Propaganda. And then there's a break. And then in Fine Arts later, Li Bao from Basic Biomedical Sciences is talking about the neuroscience behind synesthesia, right? Perceiving colors as sounds and things like that. And then there are a whole variety of musical performances that are associated with this. And so the musical performances that are tied in, which you can find on the fine arts calendar at USD, extend beyond the days of the conference. Then the keynote speech is 11 o'clock on Thursday, again in Colton in Fine Arts, which is a visiting professor of music, Keith Sally from Shenandoah University, called Regarding the Humanities and the Human, Exploring Musical Serialism Through Metaphors.
Wow. So I'm not going to get away with calling in sick because everybody is going to know better. They'll know where to find me. Not that I would do that anyway, but it sounds like a fabulous way to spend the day.
There's some other stuff in the evenings, too.
Really?
So,
okay.
So well, you can find the program online at USD's Fine Arts and the calendar.
So let's talk about what you teach then.
I'm the modern European historian here at the University of South Dakota, so I teach classes on Russian history, which is my specialty, so I have a two-semester Russian history sequence that I do every other year. This year I'm actually doing my German sequence, so I'm teaching a class on the Holocaust right now, which I believe you're interviewing Inga Auerbacher on Friday, who's going to be just to pitch something else that's coming up. She's going to be on campus. She's a childhood survivor of the Holocaust. She's going to be on campus on Monday the 3rd, giving a public talk at 10 a.m. And then I believe you're interviewing her Friday afternoon.
It might be Thursday.
Thursday.
I think it's a Thursday on this program there. So looking forward to that. So art, sound, color, shape, and the Soviet propaganda. Where do you want to begin? I think we better put into context what historical period we're talking about and how this sort of place becomes the Soviet Union.
Right. So during World War I in 1917, in February of 1917, the Russian Empire collapses. There are a series of major strikes in February and in March, and essentially the military stops obeying the last emperor, who's Nicholas II, and he's forced to abdicate. And so this is called the February Revolution. And at the end of the February Revolution, you have two dueling governments that have different sets of authority and neither can overthrow the other one. One of them comes out of the old legislature, which is called the Duma, and the other one is a revolutionary Soviet or a revolutionary council, which is revolutionary groups and workers' groups. It has sort of authority on the ground to control the telegraph wires and control how trains move around the countryside. But the temporary government that comes out of the Duma is recognized by the other allies as the official government. And it commits itself to continuing to fight for the allies in World War I. There's a lot of back and forth. There are several different coups, and the upshot of this is at the end of the year, in October and November of 1917, a small faction of the revolutionaries, the Bolsheviks, one of the groups from the Russian Communist parties, seizes power, overthrows the state, and then survives a very vicious and bloody civil war, which lasts until 1921. And more Russians and Ukrainians and are actually killed in the civil war in Russia than were killed in the fighting in World War One. Yeah. So out of this crucible comes a revolutionary government by the Bolsheviks that wants to set up a communist state, which they never thought that they would have to do, because they thought that, following Marx, that there would be a worldwide communist revolution and there would be no government. Every capitalist government everywhere would collapse. So suddenly they find themselves in charge of this former empire, or most of what had been the former empire, and they want to create a revolutionary state, but they have no idea what a revolutionary state is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. Right? They have no idea what a country where the proletarians, where the working class are in charge, is supposed to look like. And one of the ways that they have no idea what that's supposed to look like is, what are its artistic forms supposed to be like? How are you going to get people to engage in this new culture? How are you going to persuade people to build it? And how are you going to create new artistic forms that will reflect this new culture that's in the process of being built? Hmm. And in the early phases, the Civil War is so destructive that there's mostly sort of direct propaganda. But when that settles down in 1921, up until Lenin's death in January of 1924, and Lenin was the leader of the Bolsheviks and founder of the Soviet Union. Up until his death, there's not really a consensus. And so there's a lot of room for experimentation, and there's a lot of room for people who are artists who want to be part of the revolution, or who just want to express new artistic ideas that had been rejected by the Russian art establishment prior to 1917, to jump on board and try out different things. So it's a period of great experimentation in all of the arts, in painting, in sculpture, in theater, in music, and in movies. And over time, that message gets, those varieties of forms get closed down into what Soviet authorities decide is the official artistic form of the Soviet Union, which is called socialist realism. Socialist realism is supposed to depict things as they are. So if you show a peasant, you can't show a peasant as an abstract red triangle. You have to show a peasant as someone who looks like a peasant. So it's supposed to be realistic in that sense. But it's also, socialist realism is supposed to convey the optimism of what the future perfect communist state will look like. Mm-hmm. So over time, so what socialist realism is sort of gets ossified, and it gets changed into something that becomes sort of a formula that gradually just sort of people quit paying attention to, and it's drained of vitality in a lot of cases. During the period where, in the 1920s and then in the early 1930s, when that wasn't settled yet, there was still a lot of excitement, and there was still some room for experimentation.
So what do we see people trying to do at that point, who are sort of enthusiastic and not yet being told exactly what the formula is? Where do they go?
Well, some of them think that what you need to do is you figure out what the majority of people actually like, and you try and work upwards from there. Other artists think that you need to create new forms, because new forms are things that people have never heard before, and only when you can find out how people will respond to something that they've never heard or seen before will you discover what people actually like. So what I'm looking at in my talk on tomorrow is looking at art and propaganda, and the line for both of those in the Soviet Union was pretty thin in many cases. But looking at how, particularly how different artists use the color red, which symbolized the revolutionary past. The French Revolution was associated with the color red, and people wore these red caps called Phrygian caps. Marx's favorite color was allegedly red. They adopted the red flag as the symbol of revolution in the 19th century, the communists did. So it meant the communist past, but red also had particular associations in Russian culture with It was one of the colors that sacred icons were painted in. It could mean beautiful. You had places like Red Square in Moscow, and so red had particular associations for Russians as well as for the communists. It became sort of the stand-in for the whole communist project. During the Russian Civil War, the Bolsheviks, the communist forces, were just called the Reds. And they were fighting the whites, who were the imperialists, and there were also anarchists who had a green flag, and they were the Greens. So just thinking of the Bolsheviks as being the Reds, which becomes very common, and it's during the Red Scare, of course, in the United States and other places, the red just becomes synonymous with the revolution and what the revolution means. But how do you translate red equals the revolution into artistic terms? Right, that was their challenge. That was what they were playing with. So some of them tried to do it in very concrete terms. So there's one of the paintings that I show is just from the mid 1930s. Just has a bright red tablecloth. It's a trial. It's people appealing for their at a local party authorities, and so there's just a red tablecloth, right? And people understand that who were in the Soviet Union that the red tablecloth equals the authority and the justice of the revolution. Hmm. In other places, you've got red flags sometimes that are shown realistically like actual flags would be, and sometimes they ripple around and do other things.
Well, you want to hear more of this. I know you do. We are just getting started, but we're also running out of time at the exact same moment. I have 1,000 questions I want to ask you, so I'm going to hopefully you'll come back and we'll dig into this more. Dave Burrow has been my guest. He's an associate professor at the history at the University of South Dakota. You can attend that presentation on Soviet propaganda, see the images, and really dig deeply into this topic on Wednesday at 11 at the Colton Recital Hall Fine Arts at USD campus. It's part of the Sound, Color, Shape Symposium. Dave Burrows, thank you so much for being here. Do come back, please.
I will. Thank you.